Today's Teisho will be on case 91 in the Book of Serenity, Nanchuan's Peony. Introduction. Yang Shan takes a dream for reality. Nanchuan points to wakefulness as unreal. If one knows that wakefulness and dreaming are fundamentally non-existent, for the first time, one will believe unreality and reality are absolute. But tell me, what eye does this person have? Case. Officer Lu Gong said to Nanchuan, teaching Master Zhao was quite extraordinary. He was able to say, heaven and earth have the same root. Myriad things are one body. Nanchuan pointed to a peony in the garden and said, people today see this flower as in a dream. Verse. Shining through detachment and subtlety, the root of creation, appearing and disappearing in profusion, you see the gate. Letting the spirit roam outside of time, what question could there be? Setting eyes before the body, you know ineffable being. When the tiger roars, blowing on the cliff starts, moaning. When the dragon howls, moving clouds over the caves are dark. Nanchuan breaks up the dream of people of the time, wanting knowledge of the magnificent honored one to be. So it's now the fourth day of our winter session, and I have to tell you the truth, I can't believe it. I can't believe it. Some people may be also saying in their minds, and I can't believe it either. one more day, right? But on the other hand, I can't believe it because it's gone so quickly. I have to tell you that your legs may be killing you, your back may be killing you, and so on, but I'm not trying to rub it in or something like that. But when I got up this morning, I just felt so clean and fresh. And it was, I feel like somebody gave me like a super duper massage, you know, on every molecule of my body. And it's just a wonderful feeling. And, you know, basically, I love Sesshin. And I feel so happy to be here with you. I hope you will. I hope you're able to feel a little bit of this yourself at some point. But if you keep practicing, you definitely will. My teacher, my first teacher, I met him when he was about 45 years old. And as I said, he had already been practicing for about 30 years. And he is still practicing. That was that was in 77, so that was, what, 30 years ago, right? So he's been practicing for, and he still gets up every morning and sits, you know? And he had Daikensho long ago, Great Awakening, long ago. Many teachers I've known continue to go to Sesshin, even, you know, there's a man named Joshu Sasaki Roshi, who has a temple in California and a temple in New Mexico. And he's 100, he's either 100 or 101. And he still does 6 or 7 sesshins every year, you know? And you can say, why, for God's sake? And one possible explanation is that his compassion for humanity is so great that he's willing to put up with agony like this to help others. And indeed, he is a very compassionate person and has made extraordinary personal sacrifices, no question about that. But it would not be true to say that going to Sesshin is one of those sacrifices. At a certain point in your training, this is like a pure pleasure. It's pure pleasure. And it might be a little hard to believe that right now, but if you just keep practicing, one day this will happen. I mean, I noticed this about my teacher, Genki Roshi, because, you know, we would start doing Sesshin, and he would be rather quiet, and as the Sesshin would go on, he would get crazier and crazier, you know. Really, I mean, his personal style was, he was a very friendly, warm person, but he would get, you know, crazy. He'd be, you know, laughing and making jokes, you know. And my other teacher, Webb Roshi, was a junior partner in that partnership. And Webb was very much, very highly respected American who went to Japan and received Dharma transmission from a very well-known teacher. And actually, my second teacher wanted my second teacher to stay in Japan. The Rinzai organization wanted this American to stay in Japan and operate a temple in Kameoka. Try to get it going and make it an international Zen center. As it turns out, my teacher decided to come back to the United States instead, but he was very respected, and he was younger than Genki Roshi, and basically had a different style. And he was much, at that time, he's changed a lot, but he was much more formal in his practice. And so when the Sesshin would start, well, let me just explain it. Genki would do Teisho and Dokusan, and Webb would translate, generally. As the Sesshin would go on, Genki would start getting crazier and crazier, you know? And he'd be telling jokes and making faces and stuff, you know? And you could see that this made Webb uneasy, right, you know, because he wanted everything to be by the book, you know. He was like a younger Roshi, so he wanted everything to be like, you know, by the book. And Genki would get, you know, crazy, and he'd laugh, you know, he'd be laughing, and things like I mentioned yesterday, he would make noodles, you know. We'd all be, you know, sitting there at 9:30 at night, you know. And your legs are killing you, and you're thinking, oh my God, how am I ever going to get through this last hour, you know? And then the door would burst in, and Genki Roshi would have one of these wheeled carts from the kitchen, and a big bowl of noodles, you know, like the udon, you know, like giant, like, you know, like one of these big boxes he'd have cooked up. There was like, you know, I don't know how many pounds of noodles, and underneath that was another giant bowl holding soy sauce, and with a little bit of horseradish and green onions in it, you know. And then, you know, we'd all be sitting in the temple at 9:30, you know, going, you know, you eat noodles in Japan, you slurp your noodles, you know. Sorry, but you'd just be, the temple, you know. And he would just get, you know, crazy, you know. And I never understood this, you know, but I understand now. It's not my personal style, you know, but he was just very very happy person, and being a Sesshin made him very happy, you know. And there was another famous Roshi in the same lineage as Genki Roshi. His name was Soen Roshi. And Soen Roshi, too, as Sesshin would go on, he would get just like crazy, and he would, you have to, you know, watch yourself, actually, because you just get a little too happy, and you can make mistakes, you know. careless mistakes, and you know, lose track of the time and things like that. But Soen Roshi was like a practical joker, you know. He was really so his Dokusan room was very dark, right? And at one time he actually took off his robes and put them on a chair and put them in, you know, the altar was there, and there was this he put the chair on the peg, you know. And this would really happen, you know. People said this would, and people would come in and go, "Oh, Roshi, you know, my legs are killing me. I'm not making any progress with my koan." And he'd jump out, boom! Now this can actually be a problem, you know. I mean, Webb was right, you know. Webb had a point, you know. In Japanese Zen talk, there's a saying actually about some teachers is that they don't have enough thatch on their hut. Yeah, isn't that interesting? And the idea is that you know, after you have Daikensho and you've lived in this reality, you still have to be able to function, right, in sort of a confused daily reality of ordinary humans. And there's a real tension, believe it or not, you know. I mean, because if you experience deeply the timelessness of reality, you know, the clock reality becomes meaningless, you know. And indeed, you know, We used to go to sit at Kugeihan before we had our temple temple building. We had a house where we sat, and we called it Kugeihan. It was up on a mountain in South Seattle, and it was beautiful. And Genki Roshi lived up there, and we would get there at you know, we had sitting at 5 o'clock in the morning, so we had a carpool, and we would all drive down to South Seattle and sit together in the morning. And we would get there, I think, around 5. And, you know, where was Genki Roshi? You know, he's down in the basement throwing pots. You know, he was into ceramics, you know. And it would be, huh? You know, we'd come down and go, "Roshi, huh?" You know, and then it would be, "Oh," and he'd look at his watch, "Oh, you know, oh my God." You know, so he, I don't know what, when he slept or what he was doing. So then we'd have zazen, and sometimes he'd just put his robes on over his pottery clothes, you know. Genki could just be a little too nuts sometimes, I have to say. Even though I love him, at the time, this could be a problem, right? I shouldn't tell you this, but, you know, Webb was really the backbone of our group. You know, he was the guy who used to drive out to scout out locations for Sesshin. We didn't have our own temple, and we didn't have our own retreat center or anything like that. So we used to have to rent facilities. And Webb was the guy who would, you know, take the time to go out and look at these places, and he'd make, you know, sign the contract and put the money up front, and he'd do all the work, you know, the legwork. And he did this year after year faithfully. He was a wonderful person, and he was the father figure, and Genki Roshi was the crazy guy, you know. one time we had a sesshin, and like, apparently Genki Roshi came out of Dokusan and he just said, you know, basically, "Well, that's it. Sesshin's over. Everybody's done a great job." And it was like day 5 out of a 7-day sesshin, you know. And that was the end of this. It was like, okay, you know. And let me just say, unlikely ever to happen here. But he was just on a high, you know. He was just having a ball, and he actually said, "I think everybody's done a great job, you know, take it easy, take the day off," or something like that, you know. And, But I could see that bothered Glenn because he had worked so hard to get this together, right? And he saw the other side, which is that people could benefit from two more days of practice, you know. So Genki could be a little too crazy. And in Japan, even, my understanding is that he had a reputation when he was younger as somebody who didn't have enough thatch on his roof, see? You know, so the rain comes in, right? So you have to be able to function in everyday reality, and you have to be able to get up at a regular time every day and this kind of thing, you know. But anyway, all of this is a way of saying that this practice is really a wonderful path, and that I assure you it's not about being in pain. It's not about suffering. It's not about being tough enough, or it's not an austerity lifestyle, right? Those are all misconceptions of Zen. It's not about militarism, you know, anything like that. This is all about maximum living, you know, really and truly. Zen is about maximum living. You know, how to put the arms around the universe in the most affirmative, loving, energetic, happy, grateful way. That's what this is all about, you know. And don't let anybody confuse you about this. This is what it's all about. And it's easy to make a mistake about this, though, because of the method of Zen is a little bit different from what you might expect. If you want to, if your goal is to really live large, right? The normal person has a certain kind of conception about what that entails. You know what I mean? So living large doesn't mean owning one car, right? It means owning 10 cars, right? If one car is good, 10 cars is better, right? So I mean, that's how we tend to think. So living large would be like, you know, going to the best restaurant in New York and having a 10-course meal, right? And the waiter would bring out a bottle of wine, and you'd look and you'd go, you know, Chateau, you know, Rothschild 23, and you'd know from, you know, wine connoisseur that this is, well, it's $1,000, but, you know, I'm living large, you know, this kind of thing. And this is the normal way people think about how to put the arms around the universe, right? And so that's sort of like a prejudice or a view we bring to the table, right? And also, it's not just like the modern American culture. I mean, in the culture of the arts, you know, people who are artists are people who try to engage with life deeply. And that often means, like, you know, drinking way too much, you know, my wife's uncle was a pretty well-known artist. His name was Paul Suttman. And if you ever want to, I think he's a really good sculptor. And if you ever go to the Hirshhorn Gallery in Washington, D.C., please do go out to the sculpture garden, because there's a statue of a woman leaning against a wall by my wife's uncle, Paul. And it's a beautiful statue. It's really a powerful, it's a woman leaning against a wall, and she seems a little sad. And it's so beautifully done. And in his especially his early work is really great, I think. And I think that the woman the woman he's represented in the statue was either wife number two or wife number four. See, I'm serious. Yeah. And basically, he was living large, right? You know, he had a lot of different life partners, and usually the relationship was maybe 5 or 6 years. And it, then it was on. And the interesting thing was, I got to know him, and he was a wonderful person in a lot of ways. I wouldn't have wanted to be his wife, you know, but wonderful guy. And almost all of his wives, except for the last one, looked pretty much the same, you know. They all had dark hair, large eyes, you know, very beautiful, sort of Italian-looking women. And he had studied in Florence. He had a studio in Florence. You know, he was a jet setter. You know, if you went to his house, there was always good wine, good cheese. And it was the kind of concept of the art of living that's very much part of Western culture. You know, so he wouldn't have had, like, Gallo in the refrigerator, right? He would have had some very fine wine. And the cheese wouldn't have been from the cheese aisle at the ShopRite, right? Well, that's perfectly okay for, you know, but he would have been something very special, very rare, and he would have taken it out of, you know, a piece of paper, out of a cloth that looked like it was from Florence, right? And so try this. You know, this little time, says, oh, this is, you know, delicious. And, you know, he was into pesto long before anybody else was into pesto. I remember going to his house and, what's for dinner? Spaghetti. And I, oh boy, you know, this is when I could still eat wheat, you know, so I love spaghetti, you know. And so, you know, spaghetti, but there's something wrong, you know, the sauce is green, you know. And it was pesto. This pesto, what is that, you know? And so, you know, oh, this is delicious. And, oh, this is what they're eating in Florence. So this is the art of living that we're familiar with too, right? There's like the Fortune magazine art of living, which is the 5 houses and 10 cars. That's living large, and there's this kind of living large, which is from our artistic tradition, right? Where it's not 5 houses, it's 5 wives or 5 husbands, you know, art, the best. Threadbare, maybe in some ways, like Paul had a loft in New York that was worth millions of dollars that he had gotten because he was an artist, and he had very little furniture. He owned very few things, but you know what he owned was, you know, like antiques, collector's items. Going through his house was like going through a museum, right? And he knew all these great artists. He'd say, yeah, when I talk to Kokoschka, or when I talk to you know, he knew a lot of famous Italian Giacometti. He said, yeah, I was in having dinner with Giacometti the other day, you know, and this is really true. And he knew this guy. So this was his life. This was his version of the art of living. His living large, right? The Zen art of living is a little different. It's a little different from this. I guess you could say we live large by living small. You know, we live large by living small. And this is very important. You know, living large by living small is in some ways the Zen path. You know? And there's other ways to live large too. You know, there's the philosopher's way of living large, which is to, you know, I know people who, like, you know, I go home, when I get up in the morning, I sit, I do meditation. In my meditation, I might spend an hour and a half listening to the rainfall, right? And if you've been doing this for 30 years, and you're practicing a couple hours every day of your life, your senses get very keen, and it's really amazing. I mean, I'm just telling you the truth. You know, after a couple of days of sitting at Sesshin too, my hearing isn't great, but what I hear is so beautiful. It just, like, to me, and I'm sure you have these experiences too, you know, just simple sounds are just so rich and beautiful. It's like having dirty glasses, and then you clean your glasses, and everything, the colors are brighter, everything. You see detail. It's a lot like that, you know. So a good morning for me might be sitting listening to the rain for an hour and a half or 2 hours, and I get off the cushion, and that's my life, you know. There are people who spend that, they get up in the morning and they have a cup of coffee and they start reading Schopenhauer or something, you know, really. And there are such people, and the university's full of them, right? And they pace back and forth, and if they smoke cigarettes, they're smoking heavily, you know, and what did he mean by that, you know? And this is their, and they're mostly irritated all the time, right? You know, really. I mean, that's the philosopher's life. You know, they're irritated, and if anybody says anything they disagree with it, they pounce on it. No, you know, it's not like that. You know, that's their version of living large. You know, and there's the other schools of Buddhism which have a sort of different vision of what it's like to live large, you know. So, for example, Tibetan Buddhism is quite different in some ways from Zen, you know, and also Vipassana. You know, when the Buddha started teaching meditation, what he taught was breath, perception, susokukan, breath, perception, meditation. That's the foundation of Buddhist meditation. It's tremendously important, not a kindergarten. It's really the Buddha taught a breath perception meditation, and he taught a kind of meditation called jhana meditation, which is just an elaboration on breath, in a way you could say, an elaboration on breath perception meditation. So you could go the whole route just by doing a breath perception meditation. It would be fine. Although there might be some complications, and I'll get to those if I might get to those. Yeah. The thing is that that was early Buddhism, and then there's a kind of meditation practice called Vipassana, which had been revived in India by the great Goenkaji, really a tremendously creative and I think noble person. And Goenkaji practices a kind of meditation called Vipassana. And in Vipassana meditation, you cultivate just mindfulness of everything that's happening in your consciousness all the time. See, their meditation, they sit like this, but instead of doing koans, or instead of focusing on the breath, they just focus on awareness itself. So, you know, when you're sitting on your cushion, you know, at one moment you're having a thought, right? You're thinking. And so, you know, in their meditation practice, you become aware that you're thinking, or you actually say in your mind the word thinking. So you're sitting there and you say thinking. Then pain in your knee. So you register something like feeling or pain, right? So thought, pain. You know, then you might be aware that you're hungry. Then you might be aware of a thought. Then you might be aware of, you know, a pain in your back, you know. And so you're just constantly aware of you're paying attention to each moment of awareness. This is takes tremendous mental control. Tremendous mental control, this Vipassana method. And, you know, they have Dokusan too, something like Dokusan, but, you know, the teacher will just say, the teacher will say to the student something like this: I want you to tell me about walking across the room. And basically, you know, some of these students who are doing this will walk, it'll take them an hour to walk, you know, from here to the door. Because as they walk, they're noticing every sensation, every kind of awareness. So when you step on the ground, of course it makes a pressure on your foot. So you register your foot, then you register, you know, you register different kinds of inputs into your awareness as you walk across the room. And when the teacher asks you to explain walking, the teacher's trying to see how much attention you paid, how much meticulous, detailed attention you paid to the experience of walking from here to the door. And it takes an hour because they're paying attention to every little moment of consciousness. And the teacher might say, tell me about combing your hair. And if you just say, well, you know, I comb my hair, right? The teacher just says, well, you're not, you know, you weren't paying attention, were you? You know, and if you say, well, I put the comb in my hair and I pulled it down, you know, you weren't paying attention. So there's, if you actually observe your awareness as you're combing your hair, the hair is present, the hair disappears, there's other kinds of sensations, there's other, as you're combing your hair, you might, your body awareness of other kinds might disappear. Sound might become more prominent, might become less prominent, see? So the teacher who's very adept at doing this, this kind of mindfulness meditation, can really see in an instant, in Dokusan, they don't call it Dokusan, but in the interview, whether you've actually been cultivating attention or whether you've just been, you know, doodling around in your head, see? So that's live in large for Vipassana people. And Tibetan Buddhism, of course, has like its own approach, which is like gods and goddesses and heavens and hells and, you know, basically you do visualization, these meditation practices all emerged to help people wake up. So many people couldn't do Vipassana meditation. Later Buddhists invented things like devotional practices, people who can't concentrate. You know, there are people who just can't do Zazen or anything like breath perception meditation. Their minds are just too distracted and too pulled in this direction and that. And in early Buddhism, basically people would say, well, gee, it's just not your time yet to wake up, right? But in later Buddhism, people were very compassionate. They said, okay, you might not be able to sit now, but maybe in a year you could sit, see? So why don't we give you some devotional practice? Focus your mind on this goddess called Tara, or just say, Namu Amida Butsu, Namu Amida Butsu, over and over and over and over again. And just have a heart of devotion. And after about a year, they have mental focus, and they could enter samadhi. So this is, Tibetan Buddhism is full of, they try to do this representation of like the vastness of the universe with, you know, Buddhas, and you see their pictures, and there's a teacher at the center, and there's all these Buddhas up in heaven, and there's all these dancing dakinis and asuras, and there are figures down below, angry, wrathful deities, and okay, and so this is their view of it, you know. The Zen view is like, our way is to live large by living small. We simplify, right? Instead of trying to be aware of, say, everything you do as you walk across the room or everything you're experiencing in this moment, we say, let's start with something simple, although it's not simple. Let's take one thing, the breath, okay? And let's try to just be present with the breath. And, you know, everybody starts out by thinking, phew, I can do that, you know, that's easy enough, right? The breath, who doesn't? Everybody breathes, I know about the breath. And so, you know, if you spend 5 days watching your breath, or if you, in my case, you spent 5 years watching your breath, you begin to know how little you understand the breath, right? Because we have all of these concepts, all of these expectations, and the reality is quite different from those concepts and expectations. So we sit on the cushion and straighten the back and breathe through the hara, and then you watch the breath, and the breath does some mighty strange things, right? Or seems to. And as in Vipassana meditation, we're just noting what actually happens when we're observing the breath. And this is our practice. It's like Zen simplicity is the essence of our way, essence of our path. So just watching the breath for, I mean, if you told somebody, they said, well, what did you do? And you said, I went to a meditation retreat, right? And they said, well, what did you do? You know, did you chant, you know, sacred syllables? Did you, and you said, I watched the breath for 5 days, right? You know, people would not know what to make of that. It's like, you want, you know, it's a, that's like saying, I explored tying my shoe, right? You know, I explored tying my shoe for 5 days. You know? A philosopher would just turn away in contempt, right? You know, I mean, people would think, what's that all about? You know, any idiot can tie a shoe, see? But they missed the point. It is the great simplicity of our approach. And also, the fact is that when you begin to approach something with your whole intelligence, you are transformed by the experience, and also you realize how often how false your understanding really is. See, and now this is a goal of all the different traditions of Buddhism, but Zen is often thought of as the most direct path, because we just go right to the object, right to the single isolated object, and focus our attention on that. And as I say, you know, it often is quite different the more we explore it, quite different from what we expect. You know, there was a debate, there was a recent encounter between, maybe not recent, but in terms of my lifespan recent, in terms of your lifespan, like half your life or something, right? But, basically, in my time, a recent encounter between a Korean Zen master named Sungsan and a very famous Tibetan teacher. And they were going to have a public discussion of Zen and Tibetan Buddhism. And the Tibetan teacher sat down and Sungsan sat down, and Sungsan tried to get the conversation rolling by pulling out an orange out of his robe, see? And he held it up to the Tibetan teacher and he said, what is it? See, what is it? And he was trying to express the essence of Chan, or the essence of Zen, which is to say, you know, we think we know what it is, but let's focus our attention on it and see what happens, right? And the Tibetan approach is much more intellectual. And so when Sungsan held up the orange, he said, what is it? The Tibetan said, it's an orange, right? And he thought there was some kind of translation mistake. And he said, don't you have oranges in Korea? And that was the end of the conversation. They couldn't have a conversation. Well, that's another difference between Tibetan Buddhism and Zen and Chan, because you know in Tibetan Buddhism they tend to, not only do they have all these deities, but they tend to be very schematic, right? You know, Tibetan Buddhism has it all laid out, the learned commentaries and so on. And basically, there's a system, yeah. It's all mapped out, you know, and everything has a proper name and so on, and they're very scientific about it. But the Zen approach is to say, look, you know, you have to find it for yourself. You know, you have to discover it for yourself, and the name is never the same as the thing. Right? So you know, I'm with Sungsan in this debate, you know. We think we know what an orange is, but if you're focusing on an orange long enough, it does a number of strange things. And since this is not one of the things I'll ask you to do, let me tell you about it. If you focus on an orange long enough, one of the things that will happen is it will disappear. And then, you know something else, you'll disappear. Yeah? When the orange comes back, it's going to be a different kind of orange. It'll be really something else. In fact, it'll be like the universe. Right? Don't try to figure this out logically. This is how the universe is, in my opinion, the universe really is. It's not like, I mean, look, most of what people believe about the world is common sense. It's been passed down from generation to generation by people who were very, very distracted. You know, human consciousness is extremely delusional, in my opinion. Ordinary human consciousness. You know, I remember reading an article, or maybe it was a TV show, and they were talking about monkeys. And they said that monkeys are like this. A monkey will be going through the forest, and this is like a chimp, and the chimp will find something interesting, like a stick, you know, and apparently be interested in the stick and carry it for miles, right? And so that, you know, swinging through the vines with, you know, one arm, the other hand's holding the stick, and it carried for miles. And then, you know, comes down from the tree and finds something like a rock. And then puts the stick down and picks up the rock and then, you know, goes. It's like the stick was all, you know, forgotten, right? Stick, oh, what stick, you know? And, you know, we humans see this and laugh. We think, oh, a stupid monkey. You know, how stupid, you know? But little do we know, you know, that we're just like that, right? We're you know, one hair's breadth from being just like that. People live their lives like that, right? You know, I must say, you know, it's like when I was in college, I wanted to be a novelist, a great writer. Oh my God! I haven't even gotten to the koan. Anyway, I wanted to be a great writer, and it was my consuming passion. And for about 3 years, it was all I did. And if I didn't get to be a great writer, I was going to throw myself over a cliff or something. Right? And then I got interested in something else and went, okay, you know. Right? So, like a monkey, right? So if you multiply that by, 50 generations and... 6 billion people, you get common sense. Right? Yes, that's true. That's true. And that isn't even counting the people who have an interest in deceiving others, you know. So, anyway, our idea of living large is to live small, is to focus on this moment, this breath, this orange, or if your koan is some koans don't tell you what to focus on. That's the catch. See, it's a subliminal clue. So basically, we could go through virtually all the koans after the mu koan are subliminal clues. So Igute's one finger. There's a famous story about a monk, no matter what question people asked him, he'd hold up his one finger, see? So people would say, Gute, you know, what is Buddha? One finger, see? They'd say, should I practice 3 hours or 10 hours? He'd hold up one finger, right? And they'd go away thinking, you know, oh, I think he meant, you know, okay. So always one finger, right? Always one finger. And he's saying that this one, okay. Now, if you do the koan, it's not about your finger, right? You know? Okay. But if you sit there and go, one finger, one finger, one finger, see? What happens is that it begins to go down, down, down into your consciousness, into your, I should say, your unconscious mind, your big mind, and it begins to tell you what to look for. So this is... One difference between Zen and, say, early Buddhism is that the early Buddhists didn't know about the unconscious. They didn't know about it, in my opinion. So Zen uses power of the unconscious to help people wake up. See? So there's a subliminal cue, right? Gute's one finger isn't about your finger. It's about something else. Yeah. Okay. And in order to do the koan, you have to be, however, in deep mushin. In other words, you can't be thinking with the discriminating intellect. In other words, you know, when we are in the presence of uncertainty, we often try to solve it by thinking it through, right? So basically, if you're thinking one finger, what could that mean? It could mean, I guess he's saying everything is one. But a finger is only one of 10 digits. So say, you know, so maybe he's saying everything is part of something bigger, you know. Or, you know, if you do that kind of thing, you're not in the right mental space. What you have to do is be in a state of thoughtless attention, unthinking attentiveness. So your blank mind, and then you're focusing on your koan, or you're focusing on the object of your attention. And at some point, fusion occurs, right? When that happens, there's a real, some kind of a transformation, large or small. You know, in fact, you know, the word Zen is often translated as meditation. So Chan or Zen is often said to mean meditation, but that doesn't make any sense. All the Buddhist schools do meditation. A better word for what we do is actually fusion. So you simplify, and then when your consciousness turns to one thing, this moment, something, whatever, some aspect of this moment, eventually the boundary between yourself and the world disappears, and rediscover the fundamental unity of everything. Now, you can't get to that fundamental unity, actually, by trying to take it all in, in one giant gulp, right? That's like drinking, you know, which is likely to be better? You know, having a glass of wine, one glass of wine, in an hour, with a piece of bread and cheese, or 30 glasses of different kinds of wine, which is likely to be better? You know, you simplify, the experience is so much more powerful, right? Same idea with Zen. All of you are doing a wonderful job, and what I'd like to ask you to do is keep going. You know, beautiful, and simplify, right? Be in that thoughtless attentiveness. As soon as the interpreter starts, you're complicated, right? As soon as the interpreter starts, you're thoughtless attentiveness. Okay. Officer Lu Gong said to Nansen, or Nanchuan, teaching Master Zhao was quite extraordinary. Great Master Zhao was quite extraordinary. He used to say, heaven and earth have the same root. Myriad things are one body. Now, if you've been doing Zen training for any length of time, when you hear somebody say that, you think to yourself, oh, brother, right? Or you should, right? Heaven and earth, this is like a grand philosophical proposition. Heaven and earth have the same root. Myriad things are one body. It's like, all is one. See, all is one. That's a kind of bogus, when you say. Nansen hears that and he thinks, oh, brother. And he picks up a peony, one flower, simple flower, and he says, what is this? What is this? He says, people today see this flower as in a dream. They can't see the thing for what it really is. So this is how we Zen people encounter them. So please, cultivate your one-pointed mind. Cultivate your thoughtless attention. Okay. Shining through detachment and subtlety, the root of creation. Appearing and disappearing in profusion, you see the gate. Letting the spirit roam outside of time, what question could there be? Setting eyes before the body, you know ineffable being. When the tiger roars, blowing on the cliff starts, moaning. When the dragon howls, moving clouds or the cave are dark. Nanchuan breaks up the dream of the people of the time, wanting knowledge of the magnificent honored be to one to be. So they're waiting for the future Buddha to come. And he breaks up their illusions and says, no, don't wait for the future Buddha. Buddha's here right now, in this moment.